Good evening, everybody. My name is Christina Forster, and I am the Employment Services Manager at the Greater Delaware Valley Chapter of the National MS Society. I want to thank everybody for joining us on today's Telelearning, Legal Basics, Know Your Rights. Many people with MS continue to work productively for years after diagnosis, and these individuals often have questions about telling their employers about their MS, discrimination, and wondering what their rights are. Today, you'll learn about your legal rights, as well as tips on how to be proactive in the workplace and what to do if things don't go as planned. Following the presentation, we'll open up the phone lines for questions and answers, and then you can also ask questions via the chat feature. Today's presentation is also being recorded and will be available on our website. So today, I'm going to introduce the presenters. First, we have Jamie Ray Leonetti, who is a staff attorney with the Disability Rights Network of the Pennsylvania, Disabilities Network of Pennsylvania, located in Philadelphia. She focuses on issues surrounding protection and advocacy of individual rights for persons with disabilities, as well as access to education for children with disabilities. Prior to this, she had served as co-director of the Pennsylvania Client Assistance Program, an advocacy program for Pennsylvanians with disabilities who want to work. She is also a member of our chapter's MS Society Business Advisory Committee. Following Jamie, we'll have Linda Batiste, who is the Principal Consultant with the Job Accommodation Network, or JAN, specializing in the Americans with Disabilities Act and other disability-related legislation. She has been with JAN since 1992 and is a member of JAN's management team. She has a master's degree in rehabilitation counseling and vocational evaluation and a law degree from West Virginia University. So with that, I'm going to turn the call over to Jamie to begin the presentation.
Thank you, Christina, and welcome everybody to the call. This evening, as Christina said, we're going to be trying to give you some legal basics to help you be empowered in the workplace as you may deal with changes that are related to your disability. The first slide is kind of an outline of our presentation this evening, or at least the items that I'm going to talk about. I'm not sure if we'll get through every slide because I was kind of overzealous in the information that I wanted to cover, but I'm going to do the best that I can, and at least if there's something that we don't touch on, you'll have the information in your PowerPoint, so if you need to refer back to it, you'll be able to do that. So the first thing is just a brief overview of employment discrimination and disability rights laws. Many of you may know that the first act that really brought disability rights into the forefront was the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which prohibits employment discrimination for qualified individuals with disabilities who work for the federal government or any entity or employer that receives federal funds. And then, in 1990, of course, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is coming up on its 25th anniversary this July. Very exciting. And the ADA is really a civil rights law for people with disabilities, and Title I prohibits employment discrimination in state government, local government, and also private businesses that have 15 or more employees. In 2008, we had some changes to the law known as the ADA Amendments Act. So now we have what is sometimes referred to as the ADAAA. In any event, I'll use ADAAA and ADA interchangeably because it's just a mouthful. So under the ADA, what does it really mean to be a person with a disability? You have a disability if you have a physical or mental impairment that causes substantial limitation of one or more of your major life activities. And I'll get into what that means a little bit more in a moment. Or you could have a record of having an impairment like that or be regarded or perceived by your employer as having such an impairment. So what's the significance of the amendments that were passed in 2008? Well, really, January 2nd of 2009. Well, the amendments are important because they wanted to get the law back to its original congressional intent. Over the course of years, there had been a series of Supreme Court cases and other court cases in our lower circuit courts that kind of narrowed the definition of what it means to be a person with a disability. And in fact, it had been narrowed so much that people who had disabilities like multiple sclerosis, like cerebral palsy, like epilepsy, like diabetes, were actually being found by the courts to be not disabled under the law, and therefore were not afforded the protections of the Act. Congress recognized that this was a problem, and they really wanted to get back to basics and put things back to the way Congress intended. So they made clear with the amendments that the definition of disability needs to be construed in favor of broadly covering people to the maximum extent permitted by the law. So in an effort to do this, they really expanded on the major life activities that we'll consider or a court will consider when looking to see if someone has a disability. So these can include this whole list of things here in front of you: caring for yourself, standing, bending, seeing, learning, speaking, sleeping, all of these things. And, of course, this entire list is not intended to be exhaustive. So there may be other things that serve as major life activities as well. And with the Amendments Act, Congress added a new category, which they refer to as major bodily functions, because they recognize that we're not just really talking about activities that people do in some cases. Sometimes what manifests or shows the disability is actually some type of process within the body. So that's why they wanted to include things like complications or problems with your immune system, problems with perhaps cell growth, digestion, bowel and bladder problems, neurological problems, brain problems, all of these systems within the body that we think of. The EEOC also made a note that there are certain impairments that should almost automatically be considered disabilities. And I say almost automatically because they didn't go quite so far as to say we're going to have a disability per se. They did say that, you know, you still have to look at it and look to see how it impacts the individual person, but they tried to make it a little bit easier. And for those who may not know, the EEOC is the federal agency that is charged with looking at issues surrounding employment discrimination. That's the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So some important changes with the ADA Amendments Act. Number one, conditions that may be episodic or may sometimes go into remission, like MS. Prior to the Amendments Act, these kinds of impairments were only considered to be disabilities when they were active. Things like epilepsy, bipolar disorder, or post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, with the passage of the ADA Amendments Act, these impairments can be considered disabilities even when they're in remission or they're not episodic. Another big important change. Prior to the Amendments Act, if you took medication which took away or eliminated most of the symptoms of your disability, or you used some kind of assistive device, those things could actually be, in a way, used against you and used to determine that you were not substantially limited and did not have a disability. Now, after the Amendments Act, not so. So on our next slide, we have a little bit of a hypothetical situation here. And in this slide, Maria is a person with MS. Her symptoms are mostly controlled by medication, but she still experiences some fatigue. She hasn't had an MS flare in about a year. Is she a person with a disability under the ADA? How about before the amendments versus after the amendments? We can talk about that during the question and answer period, but I would say that prior to the ADA amendments, Maria may have had a problem establishing that she was a person with a disability, although we might have wanted to get some more facts about that, you know, things that she was specifically limited in. But after the Amendments Act, I don't think she would have a problem at all establishing that she gets the coverage of the Act. So in order to get the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Title I, the employment title, you have to show not just that you have a disability, but also that you're qualified for the position that you're either holding or applying for or wanting to advance in. In order to show that you're qualified, that means that you have to be able to perform the essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation. Now, you're probably wondering, what the heck's an essential function and how do we figure that out? Well, there's no black and white rule for what is an essential function, but there are certainly things that are considered when we determine that. And one of the big things that we look to is the employer themselves and whether they determine that something is an essential function. Now, that having been said, the employer can't just kind of make it up as they go along. What they need to have is a job description. So if you get into a situation where maybe you're having some question about whether you need some accommodations with a particular aspect of your job, I usually recommend to people that they actually ask the employer for a written job description so that they can then look that over themselves and, if necessary, take it and talk it over with your doctor so that you can really determine whether the things that you're concerned about are essential functions or maybe they're just marginal functions that could actually be delegated to somebody else. So we look at the job description. We look at how much time might be spent performing that particular function in the job and what would happen to the workplace if, you know, that function was being performed by somebody else or changed in some way. So workplace protection under the ADA isn't just limited to hiring and firing. A lot of people don't think of this, but even in the application process for getting a job, you may be entitled to reasonable accommodations if you have a disability. Also, when it comes to things like benefits and compensation, advancing in the job, or attending trainings, or really any other activities of the job, you may have a right to reasonable accommodation. So here's a question for, you know, food for thought. Does an employer have to give preference to a qualified applicant with a disability over other applicants who may not have disabilities? Answer, no. The employer is free to select the most qualified applicant available and to make decisions based on reasons that are unrelated to the existence or consequence of disability. And you'll see the site there for that is actually the EEOC website. And the EEOC has a lot of fact sheets on disability-related issues that you may want to take a look at if you have specific questions that we might not cover today or if you just want to refresh your memory about something. Here we have another practical question. Does having a disability protect someone from being fired or laid off? Again, under the ADA, the answer is no, but you are protected from being discriminated against because of your disability. It's not a violation of the ADA for your employer to fire, demote, not promote, reduce hours, or change any other conditions of your employment if they're doing so for some reason that is unrelated to your disability. Well, where do we see this come up a lot of times? I actually just had this happen to me today with a caller at work. Someone called in and said, you know, I have whatever disability she said she had, and I've been working at the same company for 4 years. They came in the other day and they told us that all of our positions in my department are being eliminated because they're sending them to another department and therefore I'm going to be laid off. And her question to me was, you know, because I have this disability, are they really allowed to lay me off? Yes, in that particular situation, that would be permissible because it's not just a situation where the lady with the disability is being singled out. To the contrary, in that example, it's her entire department that's actually being changed around and eliminated. Reasonable accommodations under the ADA. Well, what is that? Reasonable accommodations can be a full range of things, from the most inexpensive measure to perhaps a more expensive measure. I know many of you have probably heard from the employer perspective, oh, you know, we're concerned about hiring people with disabilities because it may cost too much, or a reasonable accommodation may cost too much that this person needs. Actually, there's some statistics out there, and I think that Linda will speak more to this, but many, many accommodations in the workplace that people with disabilities need are actually free or low cost. So that's not really a defense except for certain limited situations. So an accommodation can include modifications or adjustments in your work environment, or changes in the way something is customarily performed, or any type of alteration, really, which makes it easier or more practical for you as a person with a disability to do the job. There are three categories of accommodation. You can have accommodation, as I mentioned before, in the actual job application process. You can have accommodations if you need them in order to help you perform the essential functions of the position, or you can have accommodations that are needed to help you to enjoy the same benefits and privileges of your job as all the other employees. So what are some examples of these things? Well, in the interview and application process, an employer wants to conduct the interview in a physically accessible location. If it's necessary, provide things like sign language interpreters, modify testing, training materials, those types of things. Replace a written test with a more extensive interview if that's appropriate. Or, if necessary, you might allow for a support person during an interview. How about on the job? We have even a wider array of accommodations. In some instances, it may be necessary to provide things orally instead of in writing. To make the workplace physically accessible, to restructure a job. And what do we mean by restructuring a job? Well, there's no obligation to get rid of those essential functions of the job that we talked about before. But if there's some marginal task, some task that's done just occasionally, the employer may be required to delegate that task to someone else. These two are quite popular with MS, allowing for break periods or extra break periods or modifying the work schedule in some way to accommodate the disability. Along that line, on the next slide, we talk about allowing periods for the person to be off the job for treatment or recovery time. The idea of telework, which, because it's becoming more and more popular just within the general public, we might not think of that as a reasonable accommodation so much anymore because so many people are doing it. But even if your job doesn't allow it as a general matter, it still may be a reasonable accommodation if it's necessary because of your MS. And then the next slide just talks generally about what are some of the benefits and privileges of employment that might need to be accommodated. Well, for example, if your office has an outing or a party, they're going to want to make sure that that takes place in a location that's accessible so that employees who use walkers, canes, wheelchairs, or other assistive devices can also access that benefit. There are some limits in terms of what is and is not a reasonable accommodation. Again, the employer is not required to reallocate or assign to another employee something that's been identified in the job description as an essential job function. Reassignment is only required for those marginal functions that we talked about. They're not required to lower a production standard if there's some type of quota, for example, handling so many calls in an hour or something like that that applies to all employees across the board. And also, there's no requirement that you allow something that's going to be viewed as a direct threat to the health or safety of the employee or others around that employee. Direct threat comes up a lot in the context of individuals who may experience seizures at work. There's quite a lot of case law on that topic. But it has been determined, at least in this circuit, that simply the fact that you may have a seizure at work does not pose a direct threat. There's a lot of other factors that have to be looked at. Next, the employer may raise a defense if you ask for a reasonable accommodation, and that defense is known as the undue hardship defense. That can basically be broken down into two potential categories. One is this accommodation that's being asked for is going to result in a significant expense or cost too much money. And the other is that this accommodation that's being asked for is really going to alter the fundamental way that I do business. When thinking about accommodations, or if you decide that you need an accommodation at work, there's no magic words. You're not required to put your request for accommodation into writing, although we do recommend that as a best practice type of thing so that you have something to refer back to if you don't get a response from the employer right away. And you're not required to know exactly what accommodation might be best for you. All you really need to know is that you have a disability and that you think that there's something out there that's going to make it easier for you to do something that's becoming more difficult in your job. In providing the accommodation, the employer has the obligation to provide an effective accommodation, but it does not necessarily have to be the best accommodation that's available out there. It just has to be one that works. If your employer only perceives that you have a disability and you're not really substantially limited, you're not entitled to accommodations. For most people, I don't think that, at least in this context, that would come up, but it has been an issue in a few cases over the years. Individuals who may associate themselves with a person with a disability, so for example, if you have MS, and your spouse does not, and your spouse is seeking an accommodation, they are not necessarily entitled to that accommodation because they're not the one who is substantially limited. Now, there are some exceptions to that. For example, if what the spouse is asking for is time away from work to assist you because of your disability, there's some other laws that may protect in that situation. If you as an employee request a reasonable accommodation, your request triggers something that we call in the ADA the interactive process, which means that the employer needs to listen to your request and then engage in a dialogue or a back and forth with you until they identify with you what's going to be the accommodation that you need, or perhaps in some limited instances, you reach the conclusion that there really is no accommodation. Here's another one of our sample questions. I kind of just went over this one, so maybe we'll just skip over that in the interest of time. And we'll talk a little bit more about the interactive process. Step one is the employee request. The request itself, as I said, does not need to be in writing, but a best practice is to actually put that request in writing. There's no magic words or specific language that you need to use. And from the employer standpoint, you know, if there are any employers on the call, I don't know, you may want to have a form that you actually make available to your employees to request accommodations, but that's not absolutely necessary. The next step of the interactive process, step two, is actually the discussion between the employer and the employee. And in that process, it's important to understand as a person with a disability, once you make that request for accommodation, the employer may ask you to provide certain things. They may want documentation of your disability from your doctor. They may ask you to consult with or meet with what we can call, for lack of a better word, experts. For example, maybe computer or assistive technology specialists or someone from their human resources department, or even they might want you to talk with somebody from the Job Accommodation Network to see how you can best be accommodated. As I said, in the interactive process, step two, employers may request limited medical information from you. Notice I said limited medical information. Just because you make a request for reasonable accommodation does not mean that your employer has an open right all of a sudden to every single medical record you have. It needs to be directly connected to the accommodation that you're requesting and your ability to do the job in question. Step three, the employer hopefully is going to come to an agreement about the accommodation with you and then implement the accommodation. The important point here is that, accommodation can be an ongoing process, so simply because something works right now for you doesn't mean that that's the be-all and end-all and you can never request an accommodation again. Quite to the contrary, you can always make a new request for reasonable accommodation or ask to talk about that again with your employer. Just briefly, slide number 32, reassignment as an accommodation. Sometimes reassignment to a different position is possible as a reasonable accommodation, but it's usually the accommodation that employers will look to as what we call, quote-unquote, kind of a last resort, because reassignment can only happen in those situations where there is an available vacant position that you can perform with or without a reasonable accommodation. So the employer is not required to create a job for you. They're not required to bump somebody else out of a position. They're not required to do anything that would go against a seniority system if there happens to be a union or other system like that where you work. Now, this is always the big question. Should I or should I not disclose my disability? And I know some of you probably came on the call tonight because you wanted to get the big answer, but all I can tell you is you're not required to disclose your disability unless you decide to and unless you are about to request a reasonable accommodation. So really the answer is, as a lawyer, one of my favorite answers, it depends. And it depends on your personal situation, and there are some reasons why you may want to disclose. For example, if you're applying for a position with the government and there's some kind of affirmative action program for people with disabilities. Some of you may be familiar with that. It's called Schedule A hiring. In that system, you get points added to your score if you voluntarily identify yourself as a person with a disability. Maybe you're applying for a position with a very disability-friendly employer, or maybe you think that your disability makes you more qualified for the position that you're applying for. Okay. I'm going to talk just a little bit about medical exams. And when those are okay, because there's really three different stages of that and three different rules. And then I'm going to just buzz through the very end of this stuff and turn it over to Linda, because I know she has some important stuff to share with you as well. So in terms of medical exams, the rules are different whether we're talking about pre-employment, which is the application and the interview process, or after a conditional job offer has been given to you, or you're a current employee. Pre-employment, there really should not be any medical questions that are related to disability. So if you see a job application and it says something like, and there are still a few of these out there, do you have a disability? You know, that question is really illegal unless it's one of those voluntary affirmative action questions at the bottom of the application. After a conditional offer of employment has been given to you, the employer may require a medical examination, but the employer may only do that if they require a medical examination of all individuals who have been given a conditional offer of employment. So in other words, the employer cannot single you out for a medical exam just because they've learned, you know, perhaps because you've asked for an accommodation that you have MS. As far as current employees are concerned, again, the employee with MS needs to be treated the same as all other employees. The one exception to this may be if you do request an accommodation and you're not able to provide sufficient documentation from your own doctor, there are some employers that will ask you to see their doctor as part of the accommodation process. Okay, I'm going to go over just a couple of these cannots because these are important in the application and interview process. Employers cannot, in the application and interview process, request disability-related information, give medical examinations, or ask questions that may have the effect of eliciting disability-related answers. For example, have you taken a lot of sick time from a former job? Employers can, however, talk to you about your ability to perform specific job functions. We talked about that. Or ask an applicant to describe or demonstrate how he or she would perform specific functions. So, in the interest of time, I'm just going to ask Christina if she'll skip ahead to slide 42, which is the confidentiality slide. This is an important question that I get all the time. You know, if I give information about my medical condition or my disability to my employer, what happens to that information? I'm concerned about my confidentiality and where that's going to go. Well, under the ADA, all information about the disability must be kept confidential. The information that you provide needs to be provided to supervisors and staff only on a need-to-know basis, which means that not everybody in your department is to find out about your disability or your request for accommodation. Separate medical and personnel files need to be maintained, so your medical information should not be dumped into your general personnel file. I just have a caution there to beware of office gossip. In other words, that means just be careful who you tell. And then the next slide there, 43, is tips for employees with disabilities and their advocates. These are just some things that you may want to keep in mind if you're either in the employment arena already or you're trying to get back in there or maybe changing jobs. You want to be ready to explain gaps in your employment history. If you happen to be asked an improper question during the interview, like a disability-related question, one possible response to that is I'd like to focus on why I am qualified for this job. Consider whether you want to disclose your disability or not. Remember that you're not required to disclose unless you're requesting an accommodation. And, as I mentioned before, if you're asked to sign a medical release or provide medical information, you can make sure that it's limited. On the next slide, if you do feel that either in the application, the interview, or the hiring or advancing process that you're being discriminated against, you're going to want to contact your state or local agency to complain about that in order to protect your rights under the ADA. In Pennsylvania, we have the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act is a state law as well. So if you want to protect your rights under both that state law and the federal ADA, you want to make your complaint within 180 days. If you don't make it to the agency within 180 days, you can still make that same complaint under the ADA if you get to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission within 300 days. But if you get there on the 301st day, you are going to have a problem. So that statute of limitations is very important. I will say that it is absolutely necessary, if you do think you were discriminated against because of your disability, to file one of these administrative complaints, either with EEOC or Human Relations Commission within the time frame. Because if you don't, you will later be barred from suing in court if that's an avenue that you decide that you want to pursue. So the time frames are very important. So those are the basics, and we have some resources there that you can take a look at. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Linda, and she's going to provide you with some information about the resources available through the Job Accommodation Network. And how that may help you if you need an accommodation at work. Linda?
Great. Thanks, Jamie. And hi, everybody. I want to just start with just a few minutes about what we do at JAN, and then I want to illustrate using some real-life scenarios of how we provide information. So just to start with, we are a national service, and we're federally funded, and what that means to you is that all the services we provide are free of charge. Anybody can contact us, but for the most part it tends to be individuals with disabilities and their employers. Those are the two biggest groups that call us for information. The main thing we do is we try to come up with accommodation ideas in the hopes that people with disabilities can either get or keep jobs. And along with that, as you might imagine, we get a lot of questions about the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we also provide information on your rights under the ADA. But our goal is to kind of keep you out of the legal world as much as possible. So we take a very practical approach, and we try to give you information that will help you understand your rights, help you come up with accommodation ideas, but also practical ideas for moving things along with your employer if you're having trouble doing that. So some of the things that I pulled tonight are examples of some of the real-life calls that we've received and some of the practical tips that we've given people. If you could hit the next slide, Christina. The first scenario is a job applicant for a nursing position who has person has MS and experiences cognitive issues and extremity weakness when fatigued. When she's not fatigued, she doesn't have a lot of problems. During the job interview, the interviewer states that the nursing staff works a 12-hour shift schedule. This job applicant thinks, well, I could do this job if that employer would modify the schedule for me. So the question becomes, should she disclose during the interview and discuss her accommodation needs, or should she wait? Now, if we change this just a little bit and we said that this interviewer said all nurses have to work 12-hour shifts, can you work a 12-hour shift? That doesn't leave you much leeway. If you say sure without saying, well, no, I really can't because of my MS, then that employer is going to think that you're not being truthful with them. And so that's kind of puts you in an awkward position where you may have to discuss medical issues in order to know if you're qualified for the job. But let's say that that's not how it comes out. Let's say that this interviewer just says, most nurses work 12-hour shifts and just moves on. At that point, you have more of an option of whether you want to disclose or not. And if you can move to the next slide, Christine. So, as you heard Jamie say, disclosure is generally a personal choice. If you don't really need to ask for an accommodation at that point and you're in an interview situation, you may decide you don't really want to disclose. And some of the reasons, you may not be prepared to disclose, you didn't think it was going to come up, Or you may think that that's going to affect whether you're going to get the job. If you disclose you have a disability, in some cases employers tend to discriminate and they may say, oh, this other person was more qualified. The benefit that some people feel of disclosing at that point is you're going to know right away whether this employer is going to accommodate you. You don't have to wait, get the job, and then worry about going in the first day and then asking for an accommodation. You're going to know whether you're going to be able to get a reduced shift or not. And honestly, sometimes it starts off better with an employer if you are having that conversation during the interview process. The problem is you may not know the employer, may not know which way is best to go. I think in general, just being prepared to disclose, and then when you get in that situation, you can decide whether you want to do it or not. But as you heard before, there's really no right or wrong way to do it in most cases. It's a personal choice, and you kind of have to think about ahead of time what makes you more comfortable. All right, on the next slide, we have another scenario. Hopefully, if we can get, there we go. All right, a newly hired dental office manager has MS, and a post-offer medical exam revealed that she was taking prescription medication. The employer asked follow-up questions about the medication. All right, at this point, should the new hire disclose? Well, the problem here, if you remember, Jamie said there's three different stages of employment, and at this stage, employers are allowed to ask any questions they want. So at this stage, if you get asked a medical question, unfortunately, you may have to answer that question. If you want to flip over to the next slide. If this is a legal medical question, the general rule is you don't want to give false information. In a lot of states, employers are allowed to terminate someone simply because they gave false information. If the question was legal and you gave false information, even if you don't get terminated, it's going to set up a bad situation with you and your employer. So at the post-offer stage, just remember that if you get asked a medical question, that may be a legal question and you may need to answer it. All right, next slide. Here we have a high school teacher with MS who just returned to the workforce after several years. She thought she could work without accommodation, so she didn't ask for any accommodations. But after working for a month, she realized she was really going to stress herself and cause some health problems if she didn't ask for accommodation. So she discloses her MS and tells her employer that due to fatigue issues, she would need to modify her schedule to build in some breaks and also ask if she could be excused from overseeing extracurricular activities. Unfortunately, her employer denied the request, stating, "We all get tired. You'll get used to it." So now what does she do? We get a lot of calls about this, and a lot of people are very upset when they get that kind of reaction. They think this employer should understand what they're going through. And honestly, a lot of them are clueless. They don't really know what MS is necessarily or what fatigue means to you. So what we suggest, and Jamie mentioned this earlier too, put something in writing. I can't tell you how many employers turn around once they get something in writing. They just tend to pay more attention to it. So go ahead and make a written request. If you want to keep things friendly with your employer, you can explain that you're just wanting to clarify what you meant, that maybe the employer didn't understand. Explain what you mean by your fatigue, but don't overemphasize it. We've had people tell us that they really went into a lot of detail and then the employer panicked and said, oh, my God, you can't do your job. So you want to explain the fatigue, but also indicate that with some accommodations you can do your job. And sometimes it's very helpful to provide just some supporting medical documentation to go along with that so it's not just you saying it. All right, on the next slide. Here we have a longtime social worker with MS, and she started having blurred vision, and which made it really hard for her to drive. She got to the point where she really thought she shouldn't be driving, so she talked to her direct supervisor about the problem and asked for accommodations related to driving to do home visits. Her supervisor said, driving's an essential function of your job, and if you can't drive, you're not going to be qualified. So the first question is whether the supervisor's right. I would argue that the supervisor is not right. Excuse me. driving is the typical way that this person gets to the home visits, but she's not really hired to be a driver. And this one, I use this example because this comes up so much. An employer thinks, well, that's the way we normally do it, so it must be an essential function. But for a lot of jobs, driving is just how it's done, not necessarily an essential function. A person who's hired to drive a bus, of course, driving's an essential function, a taxi driver, things like that. But here, a social worker's job is not driving, so I would think it's not an essential function. So if the employee thinks it's not an essential function, what could she do about this? If you want to flip to the next slide. And here I am again saying make a written request. I can't emphasize how useful this can be. Not only does it give you the chance to make your request the way you want to, you can have other people review it, but it also gives evidence of your request. And if an employer has any sense at all, they know, oh, here's something in writing, I need to do some more research. If you just make a verbal request, they can just dismiss that, and there's never going to be seen again if you don't do something in writing. I just hear it happening so much that I'm bringing it up again and again. Also, you might want to go up the chain of command. If you talk just to your direct supervisor and you got dismissed, sometimes it's good to go up to somebody higher up that might know more about the ADA. A good way to do this so you don't make your supervisor mad is to go ahead and make your written request to your supervisor, but then send a copy to somebody else. That way your supervisor stays in the conversation and may feel more respected that you addressed it to the supervisor. Also, offer your accommodation ideas. If you've got ideas about other ways that you can do home visits, if you know there's public transportation, if you know there's taxis, if you have a driver that you're willing to use, you can throw out ideas and makes it even more difficult for your employer to say no to your request. On the next slide, all right, my last scenario before we open it up for questions here. Here we have a federal employee with MS who's been having trouble performing her job. Her longtime supervisor, who was also her friend, had been helping her out by performing some of her more difficult job tasks. Now, she'd been doing this for years, and this worked really well for everybody, and she was willing to do that. Well, the problem was she retired, and a new supervisor came in and said, hey, you can't be not only doing part of your job, you're going to need to perform all of your job. I don't have time to be doing your job, plus you need to be doing your job. We get a lot of calls about this when the new supervisor comes in and changes things. So the first question is, can a new supervisor do this? The answer is, probably. New supervisors have the right to change things, first of all. And just because the old supervisor made a mistake doesn't necessarily mean that the new supervisor can't correct it. The old supervisor should have probably explored accommodation ideas instead of just taking tasks away. But she was trying to be nice, so she just went ahead and started doing the job for her employee, basically. So a new supervisor can come in and change things. We have seen some cases where EEOC or court said, well, you let this go on so long, this is really her job now. But we've seen other ones say that, well, no, they can change the job even if they hadn't done the essential functions for 2 years. If the new supervisor wants to do them, then they can probably make her do them. So let's say that's the case here, that the supervisor is going to make her go back and do her job. What should this employee do at this point? If you want to flip over to the next slide. Yes, put something in writing. I say that just about everything I talk about, I say put something in writing. And here, I mean, put something in writing about the situation. You don't want to tell the supervisor that, hey, I'm not going to do it. My old supervisor let me do it, and you have to do it. But at the same time, I think it's very useful for you to give a history of the situation, that basically what you're saying is, you know, I was never given a chance to ask for accommodations. If you want me to go forward doing my job, I need some accommodations and I need some time for us to explore accommodations and some time to get them in place. I can't just come in tomorrow and start doing my job again. That way it buys you a little time and you can hopefully get the supervisor to let you just do what you've been doing until accommodations can be explored and put in place. If you think there's just no way that you can do the job, then you can initiate reassignment. Jamie mentioned earlier that that's generally considered the accommodation of last resort. But if you want a reassignment and you know of a specific job that you want, you can preempt the accommodation discussion for your current job and go straight to looking at reassignment. And that's something that a lot of employees prefer, especially if you're pretty sure that you're not going to be able to do your job. On the last slide here, I have some contact information for how you get a hold of us. You can reach us toll-free all over the United States and its territories. You also can get on our website. We have an extensive website. It's askjan.org. If you haven't visited our website, it's loaded with information. There's all kinds of ADA information. There's accommodation information. There's a complete publication for employees about how to ask for and negotiate accommodations. So you can get on there and explore and find lots and lots of information. Also, on there are different ways you can contact us. You can send in an email. You can text us. You can Skype us. We have a forum on there called Jan on Demand that asks you a series of questions about your situation. If you want to use that form, you can send it in that way. So there's lots and lots of different ways to contact us. The other thing I want to mention is that all of our services are confidential. So if you call us and you want to tell us stuff that you're really not comfortable with other people knowing, we're not going to repeat that to anybody. Your employer may call us too, and we're not going to tell your employer anything about what you said. In fact, we cannot even tell your employer that you called us. So I think that helps people feel more confident that you can call and talk about just about anything you want to. You can call us multiple times as you go through the accommodation process. You don't really have to know anything specific about the law or your rights or accommodations. We can help you with all of that. We do have a team that specializes in MS, so you'll get to talk to people that actually know a lot about MS. We're not medical professionals, and most of us are not lawyers, so we're not giving you medical or legal advice, but we can give you some, hopefully some very practical and useful information just to help you move along the accommodation process. And I think with that, I'll stop there and see if we have any questions and see if we can get those questions answered.
Since we're on phone lines, I'm going to go ahead and start with a question from the chat. And this is a little bit of a running theme. We'll have a variation question, which is you have had an accommodation in this direct physical ever, and they're saying that
I couldn't hear you at all. I'm sorry.
I had the same problem. It was very breaking up.
You're still breaking up, sir, and I'm not sure which question you were trying to ask.
I think we can just start with some of the questions on the chat, Christine. What do you think?
We could do that, or we could have someone on the phone that has a question.
Hi, everyone. This is the operator. We're going to go for Q&A on the phone line. So for everyone participating today, if you'd like to queue up for a question, you can do so by dialing 1-4-1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad.
I'm back. Can you guys hear me?
I could hear part of it.
Hello?
I can hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
You're cutting in and out.
Were there any phone questions, David? I guess not, since you haven't come back.
We have questions queuing up over the phone lines. Quick reminder, 1-4 will queue up a question.
Okay.
We'll take our first question from the line of Liz as soon as you're ready. All right, Liz, go ahead. You can ask your question.
Okay. I have a limp, and I'm going to be interviewing. If I'm asked during the interview, oh, why are you limping, which is a very innocent question, and I don't tell them that I have MS, if I get hired and they find out later that I have MS, is that grounds for firing?
I'll take that one. This is Jamie. My first answer is, if you're asked during the interview, oh, why are you limping, that's an illegal question, and you have no obligation to answer it. So I would hope that, you know, in 2015, the potential employer would not ask you why you were limping. If you are asked directly, why are you limping, I mean, I think you can decide how you would like to answer that question, unless for some reason in that interview process you need a reasonable accommodation. I don't know if you feel differently, Linda, but...
No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I think my default position is always try not to give false information. If you have an answer that you can give that's honest but doesn't disclose your MS until you're ready to disclose it if you need an accommodation, I think that's probably your best bet. It's very tricky because, you know, if you start saying negative things to an employer about that's an illegal question, and it just gets a little dicey because employers just sometimes do say stupid things and then they get kind of backed up if you call them on it. So I think just from a practical standpoint, if you got something you can say that kind of cuts it off and doesn't offend the employer, hopefully the interview will go forward in a good way and you won't have disclosed something you didn't want to.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So I'll take one chat question right now, which comes from Maureen, is what if you were given accommodations to work 4 days for over 7 years and then a new director decided that that doesn't work anymore? What are her options?
And I can start with that one. I think hopefully the new director knows that you're receiving an accommodation for a disability. If not, I would definitely start there because sometimes they aren't told and they just have no clue. They just start changing things. If your new director knows and still wants to change things, then you're still entitled to an accommodation. It may not be the same accommodation. The new director could explore different options. If there aren't any different options and the schedule that you had is the one you need to keep, then that new director has to take another look at it and decide whether it can continue without an undue hardship. So it's okay for that new director to revisit that and take a look at it, but in the end, you may be entitled to continue that schedule, but it's just not an automatic thing. The director has the right to look at it because it's the new director.
Thank you. David, did we have any more on the phone, or should I do another chat one?
We certainly do. We have quite a few questions coming in over the phone line, so I'll go to our next question from the line of Monica. You may now proceed.
Hello. I'm not sure if this is really directed to the right people, and excuse me, I just have a bad cold. But I've often wondered when I try to use the online system that Pennsylvania has why it seems to be difficult, or actually it's impossible, to specifically select for employers that are accessible by public transportation.
And I'm not familiar with that. Jamie, are you familiar with that?
If I can ask a clarification question of the caller, are you talking about either the CWDS CareerLink system where you can search for jobs, or
yeah,
the civil service?
I'm thinking of CareerLink specifically.
Okay. I mean, I think that that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to why they don't track that, but if you wanted to suggest that that be tracked, you could actually call the Department of Labor and Industry, the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and suggest that to one of their vocational rehabilitation specialists.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And then we have another question from chat that comes from Jeff, and he's saying that he works retail hours, and his shifts vary from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., 1 to 9 p.m., and 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and wants to know if that would be unreasonable to ask for a consistent day shift.
And I can start with that. This is Linda. We get that question all the time. If an employer has a shift system that they make employees rotate through, can you ask for a set shift? And I always suggest, yeah, absolutely ask. The employer may determine that's an undue hardship. Some employers try to say that it's an essential function that you rotate shifts. That's kind of a legal argument Jamie might want to address. But in my mind, I think the hours you work is more of a schedule, and that's modifying a schedule, which is required. So I always suggest people go ahead and make the request, but don't lock yourself in like that's the only thing that'll work, because there may be valid reasons why the employer couldn't have just one person on a set shift.
I certainly agree with Linda's answer. What I would add to that from a legal perspective is that there may be limitations on the ability to limit it to just one shift. If there's a union and there's something in the collective bargaining agreement about everybody or certain seniority levels needing to rotate shifts.
Okay, thank you. And we'll take a question from the phone now, please.
Certainly. Next question coming from the line of Jerome. You may now proceed.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Hello? Okay. I think I already know the answers to this question, but initially it took a long time for me to be diagnosed with MS, and I felt weird working the job that I was working, even though I had gotten promoted so many times and I was doing very well, but I resigned from the position because I didn't know exactly what was going on with my MS, and I kept getting tested and everything, but I had resigned. Would it be possible for me to go back to that job or not? It's been a few years.
You want that one, Jamie? Or
sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
You could certainly reapply for the position if there's an open position there at that employer, you know, that's advertised or that you're aware of. You have a right to reapply, certainly, but the flip side of that is that the employer does not have an obligation to hire you back simply because you worked there before.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we can take another phone question, please.
Certainly. Next question coming from the line of Michelle. You may now proceed.
Thank you. Just wondering, at the beginning of this call, it said it was being recorded and it was also available on the website. What website am I going to so I can review stuff? And because with my MS, one of the things I suffer from is I don't write very fast. So I would like to see it and look it over again.
Did you receive the PowerPoint before the presentation?
No.
Okay. If you want to,
I was just listening on the phone.
Okay. If you want to send an email, do you have email?
Yes.
You can send an email to msworks@nmss.org, and I can send that information to you.
Okay. And msworks@nmss.org. Okay. And I address this to...
You can just address it to Christina.
Christina, okay. Thank you very much. I've just been listening and would like to read and follow along and got lost.
Okay, no problem. We'll send that to you. We can take another phone question, please.
Certainly. Next question coming from the line of Karen. You may now proceed.
I am applying for a job, and it's with a museum. It's a curation job. And one of the things it says it's required that you lift or carry 50 pounds. Well, I have no problem lifting things. I can't carry them. Is that something that I need to bring up right away? Or because I put it on a cart and I'll push it, you know, that kind of thing. That's what I'm thinking. But do I bring that up right away?
I can start with that one. This is Linda. That's one of those tricky things. I personally think that if they're talking about a job that requires lifting and carrying, and you know there are carts and things that would enable you to move those items around, and you feel like you can honestly say, yeah, I can do the job.
Yeah.
My personal belief is that you don't necessarily need to talk about your accommodations until the job's been offered. If you weren't sure whether a cart could be used and you really needed to bring that up to know if you were qualified, I think that's different. But if it's a museum, you're probably going to have floors that could accommodate a cart on wheels. And
yeah.
I think you could probably comfortably say, yeah, I can do that job, and then ask for your accommodations later. The key is whether you feel like in good faith you can say, yes, I can do the job. And in your mind, it can be with accommodations. You don't have to bring those up till later. I don't know if James,
okay,
if you have a different approach to that or not.
No, I think that's absolutely right, because remember that the test is, can you perform the essential functions with or without a reasonable accommodation? So at this point, the way you've described it, you're thinking, oh, maybe I'm going to need to use a cart or whatever, but you don't really know that yet because you haven't tried to perform the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And I figure if they have me in for an interview, they're going to see me walking with a crutch.
Sure.
So, which is another, hey, what's wrong with your leg? I can't tell you how many people randomly ask me that. Employers or non-employers. So.
Yeah, and that can come up during the
interview.
We're going to take No, go ahead.
I was just going to say we can take a question here from the chat. It comes from Rebecca. It says, if your schedule has to be modified due to having a disability, such as MS, can they make you use your vacation time to make up the hours that you're not working?
And I can just tell you, that's another question we've received a lot, and we've chatted with the EEOC about that. The ADA doesn't require employers to give more paid breaks or pay somebody who's working less hours the same amount as someone who's working more hours. So employers, if you got to cut your schedule down or your hours down, employers can either ask you to try to make those up by changing your schedule and in a different way working the number of hours everybody else does, or asking you to use leave time, either paid or unpaid, for that time that you're working less than everybody else.
Thank you. And if we could have a phone question, please.
Certainly. And next question coming up from the line of Maura. You may now proceed.
Hi. I have been working in the medical field for over 30 years for the same company, and they have just cut my hours down to like 20, 21 hours a week. They've cut all my benefits, and I am the only one they've done this to. I now work three half days, and one full day, which is from 8 until 5, which I get very fatigued, and I have asked them not to cut me back on that day, because I know they're only going to ask for a doctor's note. Now, this is a medical group, and, you know, obviously they see me. I have not asked for any other, you know, nothing in particular, other than, you know, no extra breaks, et cetera. But the long day really, really does kill me. I mean, I'm home tonight, like, ready to fall asleep. So it's made it very difficult for me.
You were cutting in and out there a little bit. Jamie,
oh,
do you
sorry.
Have a question?
Are you asking whether you should, in fact, ask them to accommodate you by making changes to that 8-hour
to that schedule,
day,
right?
5-day.
Yeah, that's a really long day for me.
I mean, really, unfortunately, only you
mm-hmm.
and your doctor together can decide whether you need to make that request.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a request that you want to make, certainly, you know, you want to do the things that we've already suggested, you know, put it
right.
in writing.
Okay.
It's
mm-hmm.
good to have the doctor's back up,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you make that request. But, you know, you're certainly within your rights to ask.
Okay. I mean, this is a medical group, and they do know my history. They've been there, you know, since day one, because I was also diagnosed with lung cancer, and that's actually how my MS was found. It was an incidental finding, and, you know, that's fine. It was great. But, I feel like getting them the book, MS for Dummies. You know, but they want everything. They're really just breaking my chops, and I have gotten an attorney. So I guess I'll just have to, I feel like I can't even take a day off because I'll get fired.
Well, if you have an attorney related to this employment
mm-hmm.
situation, I would strongly suggest that you talk to that person before you
okay.
do anything.
Okay.
Because I don't want to make any suggestions to you that
uh-huh.
are contrary to what that
okay.
person you've retained would
yeah.
suggest.
Okay. All right, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks. Okay, and in the interest of time, we're going to do one more chat question followed by one more phone question. The chat question comes from Jeanette, and she says, my job has some travel requirements. I have been asked to travel, and I asked if I could be excluded due to my medicine situation. I cannot inject myself, and my spouse does it for me. Therefore, I cannot travel on my own for long periods. Is this a legal accommodation to ask?
I don't know if you could hear that, Jamie. You were cutting out a little bit there.
I think I caught most of it, Linda. I think the caller wants to know, or the chat person would like to know, is it a reasonable accommodation to say, please don't make me travel because, you know, I need assistance to do my injections, and if I'm traveling, that's not going to be available to me. I think the answer is, you know, it goes back to whether or not that travel is an essential function of the position. And without looking at the job description, it's hard to know that. Certainly, if the travel is just something that comes up, you know, very sporadically or from time to time, you have a good argument that that's a marginal function and you shouldn't be required to do it. Even if it is an essential function, you may be able to look at alternatives. You know, if this travel is for a meeting, is there any way that you could Skype into the meeting or use video conferencing or teleconferencing to participate without having to travel?
Okay. Thank you. And we'll take one last telephone question and then move on from there.
Certainly. And last question tonight coming from the line of Glenn. You may now proceed.
Good evening. Thanks very much for everything that you've offered in this particular call. I did hear one of the callers earlier describing, or maybe it was one of the speakers, talking about a case where the employee was a federal employee. I also have just come off of being a federal employee and was just actually a week ago yesterday in a federal arbitration part two. And, you know, essentially in another, on March 16, there'll be, you know, final decisions submitted by the head of the union on my side and the prosecuting attorney on the government side to the arbitrator, at which time I don't know how long that person will or will not take to come to a conclusion. The story is well longer than obviously we're going to have time for on this particular phone call, but I guess more than anything, just in hearing what I have heard tonight, help me out, please, again, with the timeline pieces in terms of I remember you saying something that, you know, about the original time to file a complaint of like 120 days and then a subsequent piece talking about 300 days. Those days were indicative of what, please? And then, you know, any other thoughts you may have, I guess, are both or all appreciated.
Well, this is Jamie. I was the one who was talking about those timelines, but you've pointed out something that's very important. The timelines that I was speaking of, which was the 180 days to file your administrative charge of discrimination with the EEOC or the Human Relations Commission in Pennsylvania, or 300 days if you're just looking to file a charge for violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Those timelines refer to private and public employers, but with the federal government, depending on what branch of the federal government you work for, you may have other requirements and other timelines that you are required to follow. For example, the post office has a whole other separate set of administrative requirements and different time frames. So you would have to check on that, and most often you would check with the Office of Personnel Management. But I guess the short answer is those general timelines of 180 and 300 days that I was speaking of may not apply to your situation because you're a federal employee.
Okay. I appreciate that, actually. I have had opportunity to speak to a couple different entities about this, but this is the first time I've ever been able to be in on a call like this, and this has been well better than I thought it was going to be. So thank you very much, and thank you for that answer. And so the federal agency that I've been an employee with is the United States Army. So is there anything specific or any, you know, an avenue that I should be looking at more specifically?
I would look to the Office of Personnel Management website. Unfortunately, I don't know the specific time frames, if any, that apply to the U.S. Army.
Fair enough.
Okay, great. Thank you, everybody, for being a part of this call. I know we had a lot of questions that we were not able to get to, but if you wanted to have some follow-up for those questions, you can feel free to call the 1-800-FIGHT-MS number, and we can help you in that way. We do have a few polling questions, if you could please stay on to answer them, and we do ask that you answer them on your computer. And thanks again, everybody, for being here tonight.